Patient, when unknown forces struck the edge of ecology.
Hitler in Ireland. It's March the 3rd, 2019, and I'm with Michael Doherty, an Irishman with an extraordinary story to tell concerning Adolf Hitler, who is generally thought to have died in a bunker as Berlin fell in 1945 at the end of World War II. However, Michael has a rather different version of events to tell. Michael, welcome to the information. Thanks for agreeing to meet us and talk today.
Thank you, Peter.
So this happens a lot nearer to home. Well, we're in the southeast of England here, but a lot nearer to here than we might have thought, thinking of Germany. You're from...
Donegal.
And that's in Republic of Ireland.
Yeah. It's an Inishowen island off the coast of Donegal. It's off the northwest coast. It's a peninsula. There was a factory built there before World War II by the Germans.
Okay, so...
One of five. The alcohol factory, it was called.
Is that in the 1930s?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is well documented that they built a factory. It's well documented that, you know, there was Germans there and Ireland was neutral during the war and what have you. But what people don't know is that they dug a massive pit and ran an old railway, reopened an old railway track that was disused to run into the pit. I played on the buffer as a child and watched men disposing bodies in prisoner of war uniforms in 1973 and 74.
That's quite a jump from the 30s. This had been there all that time.
Yes.
The war is over.
Yes.
We're going through the 50s, 60s. You're born in the late 60s, maybe.
Yeah, 68,
so
yeah.
Kind of my kind of age, maybe. Mm-hmm. So you're playing around. What would you see this as? Would you see it as just a playground or you see it as a factory? How did you...
Yeah, well, it was our playground as such. There was four or five of us, usually. And then there was two or three, and then there was only myself. Oh, I used to go there by myself,
yeah,
because nobody else would go there.
Were you warned not to go there?
Oh, yeah, we were all very well warned not to go there. But now and again, you'd meet some lads from the other side of town who made their way in there, and actually met one of them recently, and we were talking about it. And the only thing he had to say about it was that, you know, if we were caught by the men who worked there, we would never have been seen again. And there was nothing anybody could have done about it. Mm. The fact of the matter was they would have got away with it.
Mm.
And that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm doing this podcast.
Mm. Mm.
Because they got away with a lot of things like that.
At that age, what was your understanding of being of this... What was going on in there? Would you have known about the war? Would you have had any knowledge of the Second World War? It's obviously that happened quite a long time before.
Nothing at all. I didn't know anything about the war. I didn't know anything about... I was just interested in my surroundings. We had moved from a thatched house outside the town, which had no... it had one light bulb and no running water, so we used to collect water from the well. But this house near our town was new. It had water, it had electricity, blah, blah, blah. And there wasn't very many houses to choose from in Donegal at the time. And my father took us there, and it was all fairly normal until we started living there. I remember sneaking through the fields in the factory, through the fences, walking up to a fence. There was an armed guard who came out to smoke a cigarette on top of a metal steps. And he didn't see me, but... I wasn't afraid because I didn't understand there was any danger. But when I looked in through the fence, there was a young man pushing a cart with five or six bodies of dead men. Most of them were dead. One of them was actually moving or trying to move. He was emaciated. He looked like a very tall man. Maybe it was just the shape of him, but his face was emaciated. The bones were sticking out. His cheekbones were sticking out through the skin. And he was trying to move, but the young guy was fit and healthy. He pushed the cart up to the front, up to a red brick box beside a huge chimney, the alcohol factory chimney. And there was a metal door about 4 or 5 foot high, two foot wide. And the young guy who pushed the cart was actually the first one to go in. They just grabbed him and threw him in. And as he tried to get out, this big, huge guy and a man in sort of military uniform were just grabbing an arm and a leg and tossing him in on top of him. And the third time he tried to get out, there was a big, fat guy. He hit him in the middle of the face with an iron shaped like a T, looked like maybe for scraping ashes, and shouted, "Get in there!" And he hit him in the face with it, and he fell back, and he slammed the door. That was the end of it. I mean, that looked to me at like some kind of game. But when I walked away from there, and I seen the guard up on the roof, it was then I sort of realised that I had to run. I didn't understand that there was danger. I was too young. I was just looking this activity inside this fence. But when I was walking away and I realised the guy was an armed guard and these guys were putting people in a box, so then I started running then.
Did you tell anyone what you'd seen?
Yes, I did. I did tell people. They were laughing, you know. To begin with, they were laughing for the first few weeks and that. But we kept going there, several of us. And I got a crew together to go. There were several of us used to go there, but then they were warned not to go.
So when you say military uniforms, how are we talking German, sort of World War II-ish uniform or more?
Yes, one, you wouldn't recognise them as anything in particular, but they were military dressed. One guy in particular who drove a tractor down there every day, he had a Davy Brown tractor, a very tall man. He was sitting at Goring's trial, at the Nuremberg trial. He's got a bald head, a very tall man. He actually wore the hat without the skull and crossbones. It was old and wrinkled, and the skull and crossbones and the signatures or whatever was gone from it, you know, the badges, whatever. But it was one of those hats, certainly. He also wore the boots, those Nazi boots.
So he's saying this is a kind of prison camp or forced labour camp, something of that kind, operating under the guise of the alcohol factory.
Yes.
This is kind of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And who would you say was running it? Were they...
I know it was built. I don't know where the people came from who ran it, because it was never very clear who actually worked there. You know, it was very hard to get anyone to talk about the alcohol factory or who worked in it. And some of the people who did work in it would have certainly, if they didn't come from Germany or somewhere, then their parents did. But there was local people who worked there. But how local they were, I don't know, because they could have had German ancestry, do you see?
Could have been there for a long time.
Yeah. And I know also that a lot of people on the island had disappeared. A lot of people in the island died mysteriously and disappeared. Mm. You know, even before I was born, this was happening, long before I was born. And...
So it's been going on a long time, obviously, if it went back to
the 30s
and through the war. It's gone on a long time.
Yeah, there are other people who did see the similar things and are aware of similar things, but they don't talk about it. And if they do talk about it, it's very, very little and very, very quietly.
Well, Mark, I know you've written a book about this. What kind of general spread of narrative do you take in the book in terms of taking that incident and looking at the whole... experience? I mean, when did this sort of end? When did you leave the area? At what point were you kind of aware of this whole situation? Is it even ongoing now, or has it kind of ended by now?
The factory's gone. The pit is still there. You can see it on Google Map, or you could. Yeah. I mean, myself and someone else went to the pit, but we had to follow the river there. Because we didn't want to get seen walking through the fields, because we weren't quite sure what would have happened or how much danger we were in. So we just decided to, you know, err on the side of caution, and we followed the river up maybe a mile and got out of the river at the pit, because it's the only access that I know of. Well, I grew up there, so I knew how to get there. And we, you know, I showed this certain party of the pit, and other people too, because they had heard about it, and they had heard about the what had happened around it, and if was it real or was it fact, or was it, you know, was it, you know, hearsay. So I took them there and told them exactly what happened, and it's in the book what was happening. I mean, I wasn't there all the time, so I'm sure there was a lot more happening than that than I saw.
Yeah.
But I know they were disposing of bodies there in prisoner of war uniforms.
So these were being held as prisoner in
yes.
this compound.
And worked to death.
Working there, yeah. And were, who were these prisoners? Do we have any idea?
One guy in particular was the only one I got to know. There is one guy who... or maybe more than one that I know of, that got away from there and grew up in the community. And I'm not going to say his name, but I know about 10 years ago he was beaten within an inch of his life, and I think he was left for dead. But he survived that. Another guy who escaped from there was actually the main instigation, I suppose, of Hitler's execution in 1974.
Now, this is turning to a very important part of the story, because your book is called Persona non grata,
yeah.
which does, I assume, refer to Hitler.
Yeah.
You're saying, I mean, just saying your own words, you're saying that Hitler was actually there in this camp. Was he a prisoner, or was he running it, or what was his status there?
He had several houses in the area. And several different names. How many houses, I don't know. I know that some of them were connected under the ground. And I've heard from a good authority different things about where he was living and what he was doing, but I'm only interested in what I know myself to be fact, and that is the fact is he was living underneath a jeweller shop in Carndonagh. He was also living... in a house on the outskirts of Carndonagh, and another house in Ternaleg, which we knew as Miss Alice's house, which was a big, well-kept, you know, well-kept orchards, cherry trees, a drive. I even knew the gardener. The gardener is actually one of the workers that were in the... Not the prisoners, mind you, but there was actual workers in the factory, as well as prisoners, which were different... So the workers, where they were from, I'm not sure. But he did work in the factory in the 1930s and 40s. And in his 70s, when I was a boy, he was the gardener for the big white house that we called Miss Alice's house, which belonged to Adolf Hitler. We saw him driving in there once, but we didn't know who he was. We didn't know who this man was. He was just an old... angry looking man with a little grey moustache, kind of a hump on his back, sort of thin and sort of wiry, but didn't look unhealthy or weak or anything, you know, quite strong. And
you're saying you wouldn't, as a boy, you probably wouldn't have known him as Hitler in terms of his name. You probably wouldn't have known a lot about the Second World War, but did you gradually become aware that he was a notorious figure? You could recognise him because of the moustache?
I didn't know, and I'm sure most of the guys didn't know who he was. I mean, the guys who met him, because all my schoolmates met him in the school. He came into the school. But I had met him before that in a watch shop that I wandered into. I thought the watch shop was a pub, a public house for drinking. And I walked in there, and the door wasn't locked properly. I turned the handle on the door and walked in. The floor was hollow. I could hear voices downstairs, and this old man walked up the stairs and came up to the shop, and a guard came up behind him, a big man, and he had a weapon. He put it in the corner when he looked over Hitler's shoulder at me. Obviously, I didn't know who this old man was at the time, but he came out and pointed me to get out of the shop, and I looked around the shop. There was thousands of second-hand watches, beautiful watches. No packaging, no boxes, no prices, no, and just a little tag tied onto them, and everything was a pound.
Right. So it's almost like a front.
Well, he obviously stole them.
Yeah.
They're probably dead people's watches, I imagine.
Did you have any? I mean, obviously, in the kind of accepted story of Hitler, he died in 1945. Do you have any idea of how he ended up on this island? Was he allowed to escape? Or I mean, is the old theory he was in Argentina, possibly? And
well, everything points to him being in Argentina until 1963. And he was supposed to have faked his death then again, or died there again, but I think he faked his death. But, I mean, they even knew what he was having to eat. So if they knew what he was having to eat, he must have been alive. But I've researched a bit of that. But the subject that I'm talking about, I don't need to do loads of research. I grew up there. I grew up beside them. I ran away from them half of my life as a kid there until I left when I was 17. But we knew he was a notorious figure when he came into the school because he frightened the life out of them, and some of the guys wet themselves, and some of them even pooed their pants. They shit themselves. Like. So this man was something else. Like,
when he came into school, what was the purpose of the visit? Was he just coming to see the children?
We were told he was it was a school inspector, and he came in with two doctors. They came in with eye charts and these calipers. They measured our head size, they measured, took our eye colours, they done all this, made us wear these wee brown shorts, little small brown shorts we had to wear.
Did he say anything?
Did he talk English? I mean,
no, he spoke in German to the doctors, and he said, he pointed at me and said to, in German, to the doctors that he would look good in a uniform, and he was smiling down at me. And I had remembered seeing him before. And I was looking at him from the desk at this point, because we had to queue up for ages, but when he initially came in, we were still sitting down at the desks. And the doctor turned to the teacher and spoke in English, and the teacher came down to me and said to me what he said, and she was telling me to tell my father about it, tell my mother, tell this man what this man said. And the teacher was explaining to me that she knew my parents, and she went to school with my dad, and she knew him and to speak, but I can't remember to this day if I did tell them or if I didn't, because it was all very strange to me at the time. There was no alarm bells ringing, though, because I mean, we knew we were afraid of him, but we didn't know why.
So he was quite a figure of authority in the area, in this setup. He was either running it or quite sanctioned to act with authority in some way.
Well, he had several different names, and he was able to go fly fishing, you know, one house that he was in.
So was he a prisoner of some sort?
No.
He was like running the governor of the setup, or
just he was under the radar. I mean, he didn't come out in public. You never seen him. Obviously, we saw him when he came in the school, and I saw him in the watch shop. I saw him once driving. He wasn't about. You didn't see him about the place publicly.
No.
I mean, the few times I seen him was over the space of, you know, a couple of years.
So you mentioned there being guards, etc. So there was quite a complement of people protecting him.
Yes.
Yeah. And they were obviously aware of what they were doing and who he was. They were,
of course, yeah. Yeah.
But there was a sort of complement of people in the area who were, you know, looking out for him, watching him.
Would you say he was a free man, though, but within this tight area, or was he just almost like a Spandau prison type situation where he had a place he could be and was allowed to live but not able to go off and do things? He was obviously very much local in this area. He wasn't able to travel around. So had he been allowed to live there, do you think? Or
I get the impression, even though he wasn't public and no one's mentioned his name, I think anything that went on in that area, he was in charge of it.
Okay.
On the island.
Yeah.
Apart from that, I wouldn't know, because I had no experience. I mean, he was dead by the time I was seven. and
well, we'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Just to ask about the alcohol factory, I mean, that's quite a broad term. Were they making alcohol, or was it a chemical factory, or is that just a cover for something else? Do you know?
They possibly did make alcohol there. I couldn't say for sure.
No, okay, it's an interesting one.
I have seen pictures of the inside of it, and I showed someone pictures who sort of knew more about the pictures than me, and he thought it was a very strange setup for making alcohol.
It seems a strange thing just to make alcohol itself, unless you're making a distillery, you make whiskey, but it's a strange thing.
Well, in Ireland in the 1970s, everybody could make their own alcohol if they wanted to. Yeah. You know, maybe it wasn't legal, but it wasn't unusual.
No, but with forced labour, it sounds like they might have been doing something maybe more dangerous that was dangerous for the labour.
Yeah,
like say a nerve agent or something like that. I'm only
possibly
making this up.
Chemicals, yeah.
Chemical weapons, chemical something factory. Like that. Yeah. To go to all the bother of keeping a secret facility like that.
Very possible.
Possibly that's conjecture, and we'll put it in as conjecture. Maybe it's something someone could look into. Now, obviously, you mentioned there when he was still alive, but I believe you said you actually witnessed his death. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The man who caught him was actually a man who escaped from the factory through a pipe. The pipe led into what's called Glendora River, and it was a round pipe, possibly about size of a sewer pipe, I suppose, bigger than a sewer pipe. Just enough for someone to squeeze out through it, and he came into the water, and he was covered in black ashes. And we were standing on the bridge looking at him, we were children. And he hid in the water. And we met him several times. He didn't even have a pair of shoes. And we called him Johnny Me Getaway, because that's what he said to us, Me Getaway.
Mm.
And we, after talking to him for a while, I stood in front of him and talked to him. But the guys ran away, my cousins and brothers ran away. And he said, he pointed at his chest and he said, Jan. And his name was Jan.
Okay. That's a sort of a European name, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Jan lived there for a while, for a couple of years, I suppose, in the wilderness. He stalked the town at night, and he garroted Hitler one night, coming out of his garage. And pretty sure it was Hitler's birthday, because he was at a celebration. It may not have been his birthday, I can't prove that, but I'm pretty sure that it was, because one, it was April, and two, that someone knew that he was going to a celebration somewhere and he'd be back. He came back with guards, but how they got rid of the guards is interesting and very simple. They took a big chance, but it's in the book what happened then, and there were four witnesses, you know, and I'm one of them.
So the book's called
Persona Non Grata,
and that tells this whole tale, basically, for anyone who wants to go into it in more depth.
It tells some of the tale. It gives a sort of a basic overview of what was happening there, but no, it doesn't tell the whole thing. No, certainly not. It doesn't really tell of the suffering that some people went through, my own family included, when my mother protested outside the jewellery shop about who was living there and what she thought of them. And they took her away in an ambulance that evening.
And what was the accusation she made against?
She just pointed out that she knew who was there, who he was, what he was.
Yeah, yeah.
And wanted to know why he was there and could he go somewhere else.
So the local authorities, do you think they were aware of what was happening? The government and the council, etc. in a way, were they?
In the Irish government,
It's interesting.
Because it's a neutral country, you said.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting, but I think if he'd been living in some place like Dublin or something, it might be. But we were on a peninsula. We were isolated from the country. We weren't part of anything. Northern Ireland, Donegal, or the Republic. And we were just in that peninsula. There was two roads in and out. And there wasn't very many people living up there at the time. So the authorities, any authorities that were there at that time, wouldn't even have had a radio. Wouldn't have had before I was born, certainly. They wouldn't have had a police car. They wouldn't have, you know, and also there wouldn't have been a lot of, what's it called? I suppose media reports about the war or anything. Because of the neutrality of the Irish.
Because the troubles were going on around the same time in the north. That might have taken the news in Ireland anyway, I was thinking.
Well, even though we didn't have that problem as such, but there was always a certain amount of fear there. You could tell people were afraid, even as a child. You could tell they were afraid.
Mm.
And you could tell the ones who were really afraid and the ones who were sort of in charge, if you know what I mean.
When you say he was garrotted, I mean, you witnessed this. Was this at night? I mean, how come you were out watching this?
Well, they needed someone or something to get him away from the guards.
Ah, right.
And I was the one that he said he would look good in a uniform.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
So, knowing what they knew about this man who was fishing at the back of the Colgan Hall...
Hmm.
They figured out how to get him away from the guards, and that's why I was standing in the alleyway that night.
Oh, yeah.
And,
were there any repercussions of him being garrotted? Obviously, it's not an official execution, is it? It's almost a kind of retribution.
Official execution. One of the people involved went down to Dublin and asked a man. And I believe his name was Senator Tracy, and he was an American senator. And they had a long talk and a bit of an argument, and initially the man wasn't allowed in, and then eventually he was so determined the guy let him in, because there was two people there guarding the place, and maybe security or police, I don't know. But I know that the man made him answer his question, and his question was, do I... or do I not have the right to protect my family? And he kept asking the question, and he got an answer, and he said, yes, you do, sir. And then when the man left, he left with the answer he wanted.
Okay, okay. Because he was thinking about the disappearances on the island and happened before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So what happens after this, then? Did all of his entourage, if you like, guards, etc., confidants,
that they searched the houses, they searched cars, they searched rivers, attics, gardens, dug up bushes, you name it, they searched it.
And did you feel any danger of having been part of the kind of almost the setup to
it was a weird sensation, it was a strange thing sometimes being up at night. You know, wondering why people were awake at night. Wondering why my father sat at the fire, awake, keeping himself awake, but drinking alcohol and staying awake until the morning. Mm-hmm. Then sleeping in the morning, and perhaps his brothers coming and taking him to work, and then staying up all night, maybe the next night. Or, it seemed to be for a long time there was always someone awake in the house at night.
So this is 1974, you were 6 at this time.
Yeah.
So how long did you stay in that area of Donegal beyond that?
Until I was 17.
So were you aware of this stuff still going on, but maybe seeing it a different way, or did it peter out?
It sort of petered out in a sense, because when... I mean, there was supposedly suicides, supposedly accidents and deaths and disappearances, which everybody seemed to have an excuse for. Everybody seemed to have a reason for them. But when you asked the question, why was there so many of them, nobody ever could answer that question.
Mm. Did you think that could have been a way of clearing the place out, maybe deliberate?
Absolutely.
Kind of.
Absolutely.
Yeah, plausible deniability, I think they call
that.
Yeah.
I was at one point picked up with a pitchfork, and I can show you the scars if you want, and put in a hole. I was covered in. Yeah.
Mm. So did you decide to leave the area for other reasons, or did you just want to get away from this situation, totally leave
well,
it
I
behind?
Wanted to get away from it and go to work and make some money, and my father had trouble getting work there, and there was a certain clientele there that had all the good jobs,
yeah,
and what have you, and it was very tight-knit.
Mm.
But I had to go for to make money, to make a life for myself.
Mm. Mm.
And that's what I did.
Mm. So was it a few years later or decades later you decided to tell the story?
It was when I decided to tell the story. There was lots of fears and lots of memories and lots of things that I wanted to get rid of and wanted to let go of, except for the fact that they came into the house and took my mother out. That was a mistake.
Mm.
They should never have done that.
No.
And possibly if they'd have got away with it, maybe she wouldn't have come back at all. But I know for a fact that she was put into baths of freezing water from a warm bed in St. Connell's Hospital in Letterkenny.
Mm.
She had electric shock treatment in her head. She couldn't speak when she came out. Me and my two brothers had to teach her how to talk. If they didn't do that to Frances Doherty, I wouldn't be sitting here today. I would have, even the fact that they buried me alive. And that's why I'm here, and that's why I wrote the book, because my mother died in 2015. I wrote the book then and published it in 2016.
Okay. So where's the book available from, Michael, if the listeners wish to...
It's available from Amazon, and you'll find it if you Google it on the internet. It's persona non grata. You can find it on Amazon. I haven't advertised it yet. And
have you had any response to the book, your readers?
Absolutely, yeah. People were quite shocked. Very, very, I suppose, not... Shocked would be the word, yeah, because they know it's true. It is shocking.
Mm. Okay, Michael, it's been really great for you to talk to us. And we'll put a link to your book on this episode.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to The Information. And maybe we'll talk to you again some other time.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Information, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.